All right, our topic for tonight is Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the War Refugee Board. This is the third of three sessions we're spending on Franklin Roosevelt and the Jews, and this will cover the last years of the war through his death and issues of legacy in terms of his relationship with the Jewish community in America and his responsibility vis-a-vis the Shoah. So we left off last time in November 1942, and Stephen Wise, Rabbi Stephen Wise of the World Jewish Congress, of the American Jewish Congress, made a public announcement about the final solution. It was covered in the major newspapers, but as I mentioned last time, this was not revealed to the public by the American government, by the State Department or by the White House, but rather by a private citizen, which led some media outlets to question whether there was truth to this, the veracity of the story. You know, it's a major thing to accuse a world power of genocide, and there had been examples in World War I of, for example, the Germans being accused of killing Belgians in Flanders Field. So sometimes false accusations of ethnic cleansing of genocide can happen, and for those who were disinclined to be empathetic towards the Jews, they might say, well, this isn't really taking place. We don't have firm evidence to prove it. Okay, but within a few weeks of Wise's announcement, on December 17th, 1942, the United States and Great Britain issued a joint statement condemning the Nazi killing of civilians and mentioning Jews by name. Not only Jews, but Nazi killing of innocent civilians. This was an important step in maybe the right direction, but the question is, what will a statement in and of itself do to save lives? And the answer is nothing. What can be done to save lives? So unless you're willing to think and be creative and come up with creative solutions, it seems like not much can be done because the United States, and for that matter, the Allied powers, don't have boots on the ground in continental Europe that can really accomplish anything. This had just been right after the American invasion of North Africa. America has not even invaded Italy yet, let alone France and D-Day Normandy. So what can the United States do at a practical level to save lives that will give any teeth to this statement? But more than that, there was precedent for statements about ethnic cleansing or maltreatment of religious minorities coming from American presidents, lacking any real oomph. So for example, Theodore Roosevelt, and we've mentioned this in prior lectures, Theodore Roosevelt was petitioned by American Jewry to do something about Tsarist pogroms in 1903, 1904, 1906. And yeah, while there was some lip service, there wasn't much else. For as far as Theodore Roosevelt was concerned, maintaining economic cooperation with Russia had priority over whatever issues Russia had domestically with its Jewish population. And then, in the next decade, during World War I, Woodrow Wilson issued statements on the Armenian genocide. However, nothing was done about it. And even the statements ended up being walked back or watered down. So who was the American ambassador to the Ottoman Empire during World War I? Henry Morgenthau Sr., the father of Henry Morgenthau Jr., who was Franklin Roosevelt's Treasury Secretary and the only Jew in FDR's cabinet. And during World War I, Henry Morgenthau Jr. had been in Turkey, in the Ottoman Empire, had traveled back and forth a few times during the course of the war to help his father on official business. And he was very familiar with the fact that the Turks killed a million innocent people and that basically nothing was done about it. And that the Nazis wanted to do the same thing. You know, who remembers the Armenian genocide was Hitler's attitude. Okay.
Who remembers
that? 1915.
Yeah, 1915, that's right. So the State Department did something very nefarious after the Wise statement and the American-British joint statement about ethnic cleansing. And that is, they wanted to restrict the flow of information so that the final solution could not really be verified as being truthful to a Western audience. That the more information, the more evidence that came to light in the West, the more pressure there would be for Western governments to actually do something to save innocent people. But if the matter could still be in a fog of war, a little hazy, a little bit uncertain, then maybe nothing needed to be done. And so information was restricted. The diplomatic pouch, which was the means by which the Rigner cable had gotten to the West, was now being severely restricted. So this was a nefarious plot by the State Department because they didn't like Jews. Okay. Now, there was a plan early on after the joint statement in the early months of 1943 to deposit money in blocked bank accounts to basically bribe the bad guys, the enemy, into allowing Jews in France to escape to Spain or Portugal, to a neutral country, or for that matter, Jews in the Balkans to escape to the Middle East. But the State Department, again, put the kibosh on this, even though it could have been effective, although it would have required Nazi participation in allowing the exit of Jews under their auspices or under the auspices of the satellite governments of the Nazis. But again, the State Department was acting in a very devious way. The World Jewish Congress wanted the Allies to support refugees who made it to neutral countries like Turkey, Sweden, Switzerland, Spain, and Portugal. Now, why was it so important that the Allies support refugees who had made it to neutral countries? After all, once they're in a neutral country, aren't they safe? What does it matter who feeds them? Well, the answer is that neutral countries were reluctant to allow the further influx of Jewish refugees across their frontiers if they thought that they would have to foot the bill to feed these people for the duration of the war, and that they were stuck there for who knows how long. But if, so long as these people were in neutral countries, there was some nonprofit entity or Western powers that are taking care of their material and physical needs, then maybe the border, the frontier would be open to more refugees who were fleeing. Wise had a rally, of course, at Madison Square Garden. He was, you know, a better tenant than the Rangers were at that time, on March 1st, 1943. But Wise was not the only one putting up rallies at Madison Square Garden. Wise now had a competitor in Peter Bergson. Peter Bergson, who we spent the whole session on in years past, whose real name was Hillel Cook and was the nephew of Rav Cook, the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, and would go on to have a sort of bizarre career as a one-term member of the Knesset, and then move to America and be a businessman, and move back to Israel, and be basically a hated person outside of his small circle of Irgunists. And even in Irgun, he had a falling out because he became a left-winger later in life. So Bergson, together with Ben Hecht, the writer, the Hollywood writer, put together a pageant at Madison Square Garden for March 9th, 1943. The name of the pageant was We Will Never Die. And you can imagine what it was like. It was a haunting experience, though, to see this pageant. We will never die. The eternal people, the Jewish people, despite whatever is thrown our way. But Kadosh Baruch Hu Matzilenu Mi'adam. Except for Peter Bergson, there was no Kadosh Baruch Hu. He had dropped religion. So Bergson was very good at securing the support, or at least tacit support, of members of Congress, of senators, of maybe even Eleanor Roosevelt, who attended the We Will Never Die pageant in Washington, D.C. Her husband didn't, but she did. And she would go on to, you know, for the next 17 years after her husband died, as basically a friend of the Jews and a reliable collaborator for things of Zionism and Israel and Jewish causes. So Bergson, he had to shift his focus. If you recall, we discussed him at length, his big deal was the Jewish army, that there needs to be a Jewish fighting force that will that will participate in the Allied efforts against the Nazis. So if you remember, when we discussed Zionism, that the earliest efforts were in World War I with the Zion Mule Corps and the Jewish Legion. In World War II, it would become the Jewish Brigade in 1944 under British auspices. But already from 1939, Jabotinsky and his successors in the right-wing militias were calling for a Jewish army, that the stateless Hebrews should fight for their freedom. But, all right, that's now a moot point. Instead, Bergson focuses on rescuing Jewish lives in Central and Eastern Europe, that he's going to be the main figure in the propaganda to rescue Jews. Fine. The Bermuda Conference was called by the British and the Americans for April 19th, 1943. And anyone who studies Holocaust history knows that the Bermuda Conference was a sham. That going in, it was perfectly clear that nobody really wanted to do anything. And this was just to placate whatever sentiment there was in the Jewish community or friends of the Jewish community that you needed to do something. So it was a show and a show only. We should distinguish between the Evian Conference of 1938 and the Bermuda Conference of 1943, that Evian was before the war started. There were real proposals, some of which were botched, like in Latin America, because of lack of cooperation by various parties. But the Evian Conference was a sincere attempt, even if not a very impressive one, to solve the refugee crisis. Bermuda was the problem of rescue. It was no longer a situation of potential refugees, but these are people who are being hunted down and being going to be killed in a final solution scenario. So it was a scam. No American figure, leading American political figure, wanted the job of being the leader of the delegation of the Americans to Bermuda. In the end, a non-entity was selected to lead the American delegation. It happened to correspond to Passover 1943 and the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. So here you have, on the one hand, in Warsaw, Jews fighting with their bare hands for their lives, and people, you know, sipping cocktails in Bermuda doing nothing about rescue scenarios. Well, there were some plans that could have been advanced had the folks at Bermuda wanted to do something. Those who were thinking more creatively had a few ideas. One was to send 70,000 Bulgarian Jews to Turkey, a neutral country, and then to possibly to freedom in Eretz Israel, that the Bulgarians maybe were disinclined to deport their Jews, that they were not avowed Nazis, that they were a little wishy-washy on the subject, and maybe were interested in being humanitarian. Alternatively, send 20,000 German Jews to Sweden, that Sweden was willing to accept Jews. Many Jews from Denmark had escaped by boat to Sweden in the prior year, and Sweden was open to accepting possibly a few more. Or alternatively, Romanian Jewry. Romanian Jewry could be ransomed at $50 a head, or maybe $75 a head. And this was what the Bergson people were claiming. And they put out advertisements in American newspapers, you know, Jew for sale, $50 a head. Was it real? So the historians tend to think that the Bergson people fell for a scam, or at least if not a scam, they had too much of a favorable interpretation of an offer by a middleman that wasn't likely to succeed. But it made for good copy in the newspaper, $50 a head, you know, Jews for sale. Okay. The big question in 1943 was whether or not relief funds could be sent across enemy lines. Why is this such a big deal? Well, you don't want to aid the enemy in any material sense. This is a war going on. I mean, aside from the fact that Jews are being killed and Jews would like to be rescued, and Jews in the West would like to rescue their co-religionists in the East, but still there's a war going on, and Western governments, the Allied governments, are not interested in handing over material that could be beneficial to the enemy. So can you do this? Will it get to its intended recipient? Let's say you send it with the Red Cross or some neutral party, humanitarian organization. Will the intended recipient get the stuff? And the answer is the British will say absolutely not. The British, on the whole, were not especially interested in saving Jews. Arguably, they wanted Jews to die because dead Jews did not have to be housed or repatriated or allowed to immigrate after the war. So there is a strong opinion in the scholarly elite that many British during the war were happy to see Jews die. they weren't killing Jews, but they were not interested in rescue at all. And any pretext whatsoever to scuttle a rescue effort would be used by them. The truth of the matter is there were elements in the U.S. State Department that felt the same way and elements in the U.S. Congress that felt the same way, that if the Jews don't survive the war, we won't have to deal with them after the war. The United States was reluctant to challenge British policy on Palestine, the White Paper, in 1943. As we'll see, by 1944-45, Roosevelt will be willing to challenge the British on the White Paper issue, but in 43, they're a little bit reluctant. Why? Because there are still 29,000 slots available for people to immigrate to Eretz Yisrael under the 1939 quota system. And so long as there are still slots available, how can you say that the British are not letting people in? They potentially will. But it was clear to the Americans that Palestine was a good option if only the British would cooperate, but the British were not cooperating. Okay. In July 1943, Nazi satellite states, so we're talking about Bulgaria, Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, were warned by the Americans not to collaborate with the Nazis in the Final Solution. But this was a tepid warning that had no real oomph to it, because what could the Americans really do at that point? Not very much. The Vad HaHatzalah, which was the Orthodox rabbinical group, 400 Orthodox rabbis from New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and a few from other places, went to Washington shortly before Yom Kippur 1943, in the hopes of meeting with Roosevelt and convincing him to take a more aggressive posture towards rescue efforts, that not to let the State Department or the British interfere, or congressional Republicans and Southern Democrats who didn't like Jews get in the way of his efforts to save people. But he refused to see them. He was told by Samuel Rosenman, his advisor, these do not represent the more thoughtful element of American Jewry. If there was ever anti-Orthodox bigotry, it was that, but put very comfortably and nicely. These are not the thoughtful elements of American Jewry. Okay. So Breckinridge Long, who was the Undersecretary of State, he was on the hot seat, because Congress now was interested in rescue efforts. Although Congress had not been interested in allowing Jews to enter into the country before the war started, and even in the early years of the war, because of immigration restrictions and nativist sentiment and the like, and old-fashioned American anti-Semitism. By the middle of the war, certainly by 43, there was a significant percentage of the House and the Senate that was sympathetic to rescue efforts. Whether or not Jews came to America, put that aside, but to rescue Jews from their plight in Eastern Europe, Congress was interested in, and did not want to hear that Breckinridge Long was getting in the way. He lied in his congressional testimony by inflating the total number of refugees that it disclaimed that that entered the United States. He claimed 586,000 refugees, Jews, came into America. That was baloney. First of all, that was just the number of visas issued, but plenty of visas were expired and were never acted upon. And also, not all refugees were Jews. So it was a bogus number. It was really nowhere near the truth. Paul is saying, in 1943, Roosevelt was focused on 1944 election above all. So you're right. Roosevelt is interested in a fourth term. And as the war drags on, he convinces himself that America can't do without him, that as long as the war is ongoing, he owes it to the cause of the country and the war effort to stay at the helm. That is a real focus of his in late 43 and throughout 44. The truth of the matter is, he won fairly handily against his opponent. And yes, he was concerned about not having the war be seen as a Jewish war. The biggest impediment to his reelection, as it pertained to Jewish issues and rescue, was don't give the impression to the American public, especially the nativist South and Southern Democrats, that this is a Jewish war. You can't do that. So whenever there's an effort to save Jews, you always throw in Goyim too. It'll save Christians and Jews. Okay. Morgenthau's aides prepared December 25th, 1943, Christmas Day report, titled Report to the Secretary on the Acquiescence of This Government in the Murder of Jews. That's a pretty sharp and jaw-dropping title. The Acquiescence of This Government in the Murder of Jews. So what does that mean? Well, it's Morgenthau, the only Jew in the cabinet, finally having the audacity to challenge the administration in a very real way and to stand up to other departments of the executive branch that had been preventing any real rescue efforts. So this was going to be Treasury versus State, and maybe Treasury versus the Defense Department too. So it was revised in January, early January of 44, as a, quote, report to the president. So it was a report to the secretary, became a report to the president, with the more inflammatory parts of it deleted. On January 16th, 1944, Morgenthau and some of his deputies came to the Oval Office to speak to Roosevelt. And he didn't read the report. He wanted an oral summary of the report. And they gave it to him. And they explained what was going on. And Roosevelt listened attentively and changed his attitude. That whereas from December of 42 to January of 44, it was Dr. Win the War. You know, the focus was always, we got to win the war at all costs and don't distract me from winning the war. That private efforts at rescue are really not our focus. No, from now going forward, from January 44 onward, the American government will engage in specific acts to attempt at rescuing Jews under the Nazis, and not only those things that help win the war expeditiously. So active measures would now be possible. The most significant act was the creation of the War Refugee Board under the leadership of Morgenthau's deputy, John Pelley, a non-Jew. It was very important that the War Refugee Board not be chaired by a Jew. It had to be a Gentile. Because if it were a Jew, this would not look right. It would look as though, a Jewish war, that Roosevelt is Rosenvelt and is a Jew lover. So let's pause for a moment on the War Refugee Board issue. And now just shift focus briefly to discuss Zionism and FDR's attitude toward Zionism during the war. So in 1942, when things were looking bleak in Eastern Europe, now before the final solution was formally known to everybody in America, but already when it was clear that things were in disaster mode in Europe, the Biltmore Conference of American Zionists was assembled in New York, Biltmore Hotel. And this was the great moment when American Zionism and the Zionist movement Bichlal moved away from dancing around the issue of Jewish statehood. You know, Zionism for a long time didn't really talk about Jewish statehood. It was always building up Eretz Yisrael, one sheep, one goat, one cow, one kibbutz, one stockade in the tower, but not talking about the political outcome in Eretz Yisrael. But once the war was at a high point and Jews are fighting for civilization together with the rest of the allies, so this was when Ben-Gurion and the others were willing to put forth boldly and openly, we want statehood. This led to a fissure in the American Jewish community. At the American Jewish Conference of 1943, which was a gathering of all the major factions in American Jewish life, so the Zionists won the day, much to the chagrin of the American Jewish Committee crowd and the non- and anti-Zionists. Who broke away? The American Council for Judaism. The American Council for Judaism would become the most staunchly anti-Zionist wing of American Jewish life for the next 25 years. Basically, they were like the PLO rabbis. You know, whatever was good for the Jews, they hated it. Whatever was good for the Arabs, they loved it. And with a divided Jewry, the real question was, how would the Roosevelt administration respond to Zionist pressure? And so at first, Roosevelt was reluctant to pressure the United Kingdom, to pressure Great Britain on immigration to Palestine, because they were the main ally of the United States. You know, winning the war and winning the war with your major ally has priority over busting their chops over how many thousands of Jews enter into the Middle East and Palestine. It's important, but in the grand scheme of things, preserving the relationship with Great Britain was much more important. However, Roosevelt did favor moving Jews to Eretz Israel. Why? Well, you could argue it's to keep Jews out of America. I mean, you could say there's a cynical approach to that. You know, classically, there were many heads of state around the world who favored Zionism just as a way of getting rid of surplus Jews, not because they loved the return to Zion or the restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the ancient homeland. It's just, you know, better there than here. But it seems that Roosevelt actually really did think of Eretz Yisrael as a good destination for Jews, not just to keep them out of America. As for final status of Palestine, Roosevelt was inching further and further towards accepting Jewish statehood. But he didn't want to alienate the Saudis. Didn't want to alienate the Saudis. So as we'll see in 1945, that plays an important role at Yalta at the very end of Roosevelt's life. What does Roosevelt do on behalf of the Jews of Eretz Yisrael that has gotten overlooked by the historians and by the popular imagination? So the most important thing that Roosevelt did for the Jews of Eretz Yisrael was to send a supply of 300 Sherman tanks to British forces in North Africa after British garrisons were overrun at Tobruk. In Libya. So the Nazis under Rommel, the Africa Corps, were invading Egypt. And the Battle of El Alamein, there were two battles of El Alamein, were absolutely essential for the defense of Alexandria and Cairo, and for that matter, Eretz Yisrael. That had Alamein gone the other way, it could be that Egypt would have been lost, and the Jews of Israel would have been annihilated. The British really were concerned about that. And that's why in 1941, there was British cooperation with the Palmach, sending the Palmach to Lebanon, and Moshe Dayan loses an eye. You know, there's a whole story about British Jewish cooperation in Eretz Yisrael when there was a real perceived threat of a Nazi takeover. But in any event, American efforts to supply the British played a decisive role in helping turn the tide of the war in North Africa. So if not for that, maybe there is no state of Israel today. All right. Well, what else can we say about Roosevelt and his approach to Zionism? Well, he bucked the State Department on the issue of Jewish Palestine. His own State Department, time and time again, between 33 and 45, but especially during the war, tried to impress upon Roosevelt that you can't support a Jewish Palestine because you'll alienate the Arabs, and we need oil and we need Arab support in the war because the Arabs don't really support the British. The Arabs really support the Nazis. And if we're going to get them to at least behave themselves and not be openly subversive against Allied rule or whatever the British controlled, you got to throw them a bone. And what's the bone you're going to throw them? Don't side with the Jews in the conflict in Palestine. All right, but FDR tended not to accept that line of reasoning. Also, Roosevelt was worried about too much agitation for Jewish statehood too quickly before securing Arab acquiescence, or at least a wink and a nod from some of the Arab leadership that they would accept the Jewish presence in the Middle East, because he feared that a 500,000 Jews versus 70 million Muslims, the 500,000 Jews will be annihilated. Now, that's an attitude that, from the standpoint of Ben-Gurion and Moshe Sharet and the others, they'd rather he didn't have that attitude. They'd rather he say, all right, let them fight it out. If the Jews win, the Jews win, because the Zionists were convinced that they could win. But Roosevelt, not convinced of that at all, was hesitant on the issue of the final status without securing some kind of Saudi cooperation or Arab cooperation. Okay. Basically, Roosevelt was better than Churchill on the question of Zionism, even though Churchill claimed to be an avowed Zionist. And if you read Martin Gilbert's Churchill and the Jews, Gilbert, you know, has a favorable approach towards Churchill, because he's the Churchill biographer, and Gilbert was a big Zionist. So he tries to paint a picture of Churchill being a friend. But Lemaisa, during the war at least, Churchill was hardly much of a friend. Actually, FDR did a little bit more. The big question where Roosevelt gets a bad rap, and maybe deservedly so, maybe not. You could argue it both ways. And in fact, there was an article recently in one of the publications, maybe it was in Mosaic, I forget where, if somebody knows, you can shout it out, about the Jews under the Vichy in North Africa, that there were concentration camps in North Africa, and Jews that were stripped of their citizenship, where they were French citizens. And then when the Americans took over after the invasion of North Africa in late 42, early 43, so what was going to happen to the Jews of North Africa? Were they going to have their French citizenship restored in Algeria, or were they not? And the problem was that before the war, the Jews had citizenship, but the Muslims didn't. So to restore Jewish citizenship was to favor the Jews over the Muslims. And to do that ran the risk of rousing the ire of the whole Muslim world. And so Eisenhower, in the end, took an anti-Jewish perspective and did not at first allow the restoration of Jewish citizenship. Later it was, but the Americans are faulted in recent publications, whether it's Roosevelt himself or Eisenhower as the general in charge, for not catering to Jewish interests right away. Okay, now let's get back to issues of rescue. So the real concern was that Americans not view this as a Jewish war. Nazi propaganda in the United States was ongoing throughout the war, and especially in 1944. And FDR was seen as the next coming of Moses. So that's not something that FDR wants to have said about him. He'd rather be seen as the patriotic American leader who fights the Great American War, not the Great Jewish War. So the concern for this attitude about a so-called Jewish war helped to kill a bunch of rescue ideas. Who killed the idea of bombing Auschwitz? So the answer is Assistant Secretary of War John McCloy. John McCloy was no friend of the Jews, was basically an out-and-out anti-Semite, and he rejected the idea of bombing the railroad tracks and of bombing the crematoria and killing the center itself. Whether or not that would have proved relevant, we'll see shortly. I'll save that for the last few minutes. But what does Roosevelt come up with in 1944, midway through the year? He comes up with an idea of free ports. What's a free port? So a free port is a place where temporarily you could store goods, except instead of goods, you're going to store people. People who are in danger elsewhere will plop them down somewhere that they won't be in danger, but they're not going to stay there forever. They're not going to stay there even intermediate term, just short term, a free port. In the end, Roosevelt changed the terminology to emergency refugee shelter. And he was hoping that there'd be a bunch of them to save a lot of people. In the end, there really was only one. Where was it? Fort Ontario near Oswego, New York. That 1,000 Jews were put in Oswego, New York. How did this come about? So the answer is, the pretext was that refugee centers in Southern Europe and the Italian peninsula were becoming overcrowded as Jews from the Balkans were overrunning the Italian centers, and the Americans had to shift people out. So we'll shift 1,000 people to the Western Hemisphere. And what are we going to do with them? Well, they're not in the quota. We can't let them in as citizens, with a visa. So what do we do? Refugee status, Fort Ontario. He took a lot of heat for this, but Roosevelt felt it was worth it. Another thing that happens in the summer of 44 is that broadcasts are sent out in continental Europe, warning Jews to hide, and no matter what, at all costs. You know, your life is in danger, just in case you didn't know about it, and plenty of Jews didn't know about it. They were oblivious to the final solution until it was too late. So radio broadcasts letting Jews know what's going on and announcing to the killers, or the would-be killers, that you will be punished in the post-war era, that there will be a price to be paid for your criminal actions. Now, the big job for the War Refugee Board was in Hungary. Why Hungary? Because that was the last major Jewish community in Europe that had not been overrun by the Nazis. That Hungary was a satellite state of the Nazis under Admiral Horthy, and it was not until March 19th, 1944 that the Germans invade, after they were tipped off that there would be a possible separate peace between Hungary and the Allies. So after the invasion of Hungary, some very odd proposals emerged out of Hungary, coming from Jews who were sent out of the danger zone to meet with allied representatives and Jewish representatives in neutral countries. So when we discussed Rudolf Kastner, Israel Kastner, a couple of years ago, we spent a lot of time on this. We'll spend just a few minutes on it now. Joel Brand, who was a Hungarian Jewish leader, Zionist leader, in May of 44, came up with the Blood for Trucks idea. Well, he was sent by the Gestapo with a Blood for Trucks plan. Andor Gross, another Hungarian Jew, came up with an idea of a separate peace for the Germans with the West, that a peace agreement between Germany and Americans and the British, so that the Germans could then fight alone against the Russians, and the war would continue only on the Eastern Front. So these were odd ideas emerging from curious characters. Nobody knew if this was legit. So in American intelligence circles, people thought that these ideas were proposed by Germany to blackmail Roosevelt, that in his acceptance of these ideas, the war would be seen as a Jewish war, and that Jewish rescue was impeding victory. So the goal was offer something that'll make it look like Roosevelt is saving Jews at the expense of winning the war, and the American public was sour on Roosevelt and sour on the war. So that's what some of the American intelligence folks thought this was all about. Was it? Who knows? Maybe it was a sincere offer. The Germans needed trucks and they were willing to ransom X number of thousands of Jews. Or it was just a bluff to see what the Americans would do. That the War Refugee Board and the Roosevelt administration decided to keep negotiating in bad faith. In other words, they weren't going to do it, Blood for Trucks, but keep negotiating because maybe it will slow down the transports to the death camps. And it did, in fact, slow down transports to an extent. But the real method of success would be to pressure Nazi satellite governments to halt the deportations altogether. And the admiral in charge of Hungary would in fact do that in July of 1944 to stop the deportations. After 3 months, 4 months of the trains rolling, they put a halt to it in early July. The Aguda wanted the bombing of the railroad tracks. Others wanted the bombing of the death camps themselves. On August 20th, 1944, Allied bombers did hit Auschwitz, but Auschwitz factories, industrial factories, about 5 miles away from Birkenau from the killing zones. The military, the U.S. military, was opposed to the use of military hardware for so-called civilian purposes. And FDR probably never even chimed in on this discussion. It likely never reached his desk, the question of bombing railroad tracks and crematoria. So the question is, would it have been useful or not? So as for the railroad tracks, the assumption is they would have been rebuilt very quickly, very, very quickly. So hitting a railroad track doesn't accomplish much unless you're hitting a bridge that cannot easily be repaired or replaced. It would take months to replace. But on the premise that it's just flat land flowing from Hungary to Poland, the railroads were not going to be all that relevant. What about the killing zone itself, the crematoria? So there were a variety of reasons in favor of bombing it and against bombing it. In favor of bombing, well, if industrialized killing requires this setup that cannot be easily replicated or rebuilt in a wartime setting, well, then maybe it's a good thing. So get it done. Alternatively, on the downside, you're going to kill the Jews who are there. So the Allies would be guilty of killing people whose lives might have been spared. Or indiscriminate bombing will be imprecise. It's a waste of time. It's unlikely to succeed. But the biggest factor was that there were plenty of ways for the Nazis to kill Jews other than Zyklon B in a gas chamber. In fact, 250,000 Jews would be killed by the Nazis after the gas chambers were no longer in use. So whether by death marches, by Einsatzgruppen type, death by bullets, there were a variety of ways for the final solution to be implemented without the crematoria, without the gas chambers. So the bombing of Auschwitz, which was the last one functioning, may not have proved all that relevant. But in any event, the army didn't want to do it. The army said, this is not what we do. We're busy fighting a war. We cannot detract from our focus on industrial sites and military sites. Was that an honest statement, or was that anti-Semitism couched in the so-called military necessity? My guess is it wasn't anti-Semitism. It was probably just the thinking that this is what we do. We fight a war. We're not in the business of fighting the final solution. Okay. So the greatest success of the War Refugee Board was in funding and facilitating the work of the diplomat heroes of the Holocaust. And I would recommend a book by Mordechai Paldiel by that title, Diplomat Heroes of the Holocaust. So you can look it up on Amazon. It was published by YU, by the Rabbi Arthur Schneier Center for Studies. And Mordechai Paldiel, who was the director of Yad Vashem, was the author. Who were the major figures who were funded and handled by the War Refugee Board? So Raoul Wallenberg of Sweden, Karl Lutz of Switzerland, and George Montello, a Jew, who was the El Salvadoran ambassador to Switzerland. What were these fellows doing? They were giving protective passes to people in essentially a bogus fashion, just handing out papers and then offering diplomatic protection and creating safe houses all throughout Budapest and elsewhere and other places in Hungary. So if you examine the total numbers, who was saved by the War Refugee Board? Well, directly, about 7,000 Jews made it to Turkey, about 5,300 made it to the United States, 1,000 in Fort Ontario, and about 4,300 who were given visas by consular officials in continental Europe, about 45,000 whose escape to the Middle East was facilitated from the Balkans, so Balkan Jewry getting to the Middle East, and about 14,000 Hungarian Jews who had protective passes from these diplomat hero types. But in addition to that, there were 75,000 Jews of Budapest who survived the war because Budapest Jewry, even those who were not protected with diplomatic passes, were able to just ride it out, that the deportations were halted. And yes, it was still dangerous, but people were not being sent on trains to Auschwitz. So about 75,000 Jews survived in the capital city of Hungary just because, you know, they ran out the war. So Paul says in the chat, okay, so Paul has an interesting point. He says that the Germans wasted their resources on killing Jews rather than fighting the war. This is an important point, that the Allies were primarily interested in winning the war. Secondarily, or maybe even less than secondarily, they'd be interested in saving Jews who could be saved. Whereas the Nazis regarded the death of Jews as a primary war aim, that winning was important. And yes, the German military wanted to win, including those who were non-Nazi, just because they were patriotic Germans who wanted to win a war. But from the Nazi point of view, killing Jews was a primary aim of the war. And therefore, resources would be expended upon it, even when the war is coming to an ignominious finish, where they're losing. But still, it's not a loss if you could kill a Jew. So because the Shoah for the Nazis was a primary aim, whereas for the Allies, preventing it was not a primary aim, you could see why, in the end, the zeal to kill was greater than the impetus to rescue. The numbers would be disastrous. Okay. But all told, the War Refugee Board saved about 200,000 people, whether directly or indirectly. Much of that was indirectly, but still, we can credit the American administration's late-game efforts with the survival of a lot of people. FDR went to Yalta in February of 45. He was old, he was sick, didn't look good, to meet with Churchill, with Stalin, and with Ibn Saud. When he met with Ibn Saud, he tried to convince the Arab leader that the Middle East would be better off, and it would be good for the Arabs, if a Jewish state were to emerge, if a Jewish Palestine were to emerge. He said, you know, the Jews will bring prosperity, it'll be good for you. And Ibn Saud was an old bigot and wouldn't hear of it. And he said, Muslims shouldn't pay for the crimes of Christians. So here we see something very important. Franklin Delano Roosevelt did not understand the intense Judeophobia and Jew hatred of the old Islamic world. He tried to convince an Arab leader on the basis of, you know, material gains that you'll experience. That's the sort of thing that goes over well now in the year 2021, but was not going to go over well in the year 1945. So Roosevelt was well before his time on that, and thus was a failure. And having failed to secure Arab cooperation for political Zionism in Roosevelt's last 2 months of life, he kind of dropped the ball on that. Whereas he would have favored Jewish statehood, he was reluctant to advance that or agitate for it without some measure of Arab cooperation. When Roosevelt died, all the reviews of him were positive in the American Jewish media. Certainly, Stephen Wise was going to sing praises of Roosevelt and give a levaya, give a hesped to levaya. But even Abba Hillel Silver, now Abba Hillel Silver was a Republican. He was a friend of Senator Taft of Ohio. He was a real Republican and did not vote for Roosevelt in 44, probably didn't vote for him in 40 or 36 or 32. But Abba Hillel Silver gave a favorable hesped of Franklin Roosevelt. All the Jewish leaders, the mainstream Jewish leaders, did that in 1945. So it was not until 1967, when Arthur Morse published When 6 Million Died, that the public conversation changed. He accused Roosevelt of shedding crocodile tears, that Roosevelt was a phony. Okay, so Perfidy by Ben Hecht, Isabel in the chat says Perfidy by Ben Hecht. You're right. So Perfidy by Ben Hecht was hostile to Roosevelt. But then again, Ben Hecht had already been associated with the Irgun, with the far right, with, you know, the Bergson group. And so his say-so would not carry the same weight as that of, you know, academics writing works for the general public to be accepted across the spectrum. You know, Perfidy was essentially, you know, Irgun Likud propaganda, and people saw it as such. So what was Roosevelt really? In recent years, this book was published, FDR and the Jews, by Richard Brightman and Alan Lichtman. And their thesis is that there were four Roosevelts. Not two, like Teddy and Franklin. There were four Franklin Roosevelts, vis-a-vis the Jews. He was not a bystander. He was not a hero. The first Roosevelt was his first term. He could have done more in 1933, early in his term, to express his horror and revulsion at Nazi takeover of Germany and the early measures against German Jewry in terms of March and April 33. He could have done that, but he did not do that. Why did he not do that? He was a brand new American president with a new deal, with a depression to deal with, and he did not want to be distracted with his domestic agenda. Now, if you're a Jew, in hindsight, you'll say, but he should have, you know, he should have cared more about the Jews. All right, well, but in the moment, we understand why he didn't. That was the first Roosevelt. The second Roosevelt was after he won re-election in 1936. And this Roosevelt cared a lot more and did more. So he pressured the State Department to change the visa rules, to relax the bureaucratic requirements, the documentary requirements for getting into the country, told consular officials to fill the quotas. He had the Evian Conference. He facilitated Jewish immigration to Bolivia, to Cuba, to other Latin American venues. So Roosevelt was active in doing things from the beginning of his second term up until the start of the war. The third Roosevelt was from the start of the war through 1943, which basically was, let's win the war, national security, we're afraid of spies entering the country, we have to preserve the anti-Nazi alliance, which means not alienating Britain. But during this third Roosevelt period, there was support for the Jews in the sense of the Battle of El Alamein, and, you know, some statements against genocide. But the fourth Roosevelt was the Roosevelt from January of 44 up until the end of his life. That's the Roosevelt of the War Refugee Board, dissociating himself from the white paper openly for the first time. The American administration in 44 and 45 said the white paper was wrong. He bucked the State Department and he denounced the killing of Jews. So that's the fourth Roosevelt. It's important to understand that at the time, no American Jewish leader was denouncing the United States for not bombing Auschwitz. That's later revisionism. But it was a successful revisionism because even George Bush himself, George Bush 43, once made a comment when visiting the Holocaust Museum that Roosevelt was wrong not to bomb Auschwitz, as though Roosevelt made that decision. The scholarly literature says it wasn't even Roosevelt's call. He had nothing to do with it. But President Bush, you know, together with many others, you know, reading the conventional narrative, thinks that, oh, Roosevelt made a decision of that sort. One of the problems is that the Jews turned against each other. You know, Bergson was a self-promoter, and he made a lot of enemies. All the Jews hated him at the end, as I said. Certainly American Jews, but even Israeli Jews didn't like him at the end. Abba Hillel Silver denounced Stephen Wise as a court Jew. Now, a court Jew is a specific term that applied to Jews in, you know, who worked for the aristocrats in Central Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries. But it had a negative connotation in the 20th century in the sense that, like, you're in the pocket of Roosevelt. You're not agitating for Jewish causes. You're just happy to have access. Had the fourth Roosevelt emerged sooner, meaning in early 43 instead of early 44, more could have been done to save the 1.4 million Jews who lived in the satellite states, meaning not under direct Nazi control, but under Nazi allied control. How could more have been done? Well, when things were being done in 44 with some measure of success, it shows that you can't just throw up your hands and say nothing is possible. In 43, more could have been done. For example, the threatening of satellite governments of the Nazis with military intervention, and post-war punishment. Secondly, warning the Jews who lived in those countries to flee for their lives. Three, send food and medical supplies. Even though it's a risk that those supplies will be confiscated and used by the enemy, still send it anyway just in case it'll get through. Four, grant visas through American consulates all over continental Europe to whoever can get, you know, can get in front of a representative. And lastly, get neutral countries to take in more refugees on the basis of assurances that in the post-war era, those Jews will leave and they will not stay behind and you will not be stuck with them. That would be a very important piece of the puzzle that the Americans could have done but didn't really do in 43. So the War Refugee Board only had 1 year to operate. It was underfunded, it was understaffed, but it did the best that it could. Franklin Roosevelt, to sum it all up, was the best choice for American Jewry at the time, whether from a domestic affairs standpoint or a foreign affairs standpoint. The Republican alternative was Nishkin alternative, because what did Jews want? Jews wanted liberal politics domestically, and they got it in Roosevelt. They were not going to get it in some Wendell Willkie character or whomever or Dewey or whomever else. Or Alf Landon or whoever, or Herbert Hoover. So number one, liberal politics, it's what Jews wanted, they got it domestically. Secondly, the Republicans were not interested in introducing Jews to government. Roosevelt did. Jews came to Washington in large numbers. And lastly, when it comes to foreign affairs, as much as you want to blame Roosevelt for being insensitive to the Holocaust or not doing enough, he did something. The Republicans would have done nothing. Nothing, I tell you. And they would have closed the doors even harder to immigration. So he was the best of all of the various options. And there were no other options because Republicans weren't going to win. Contemporary Jewry assessed Roosevelt favorably. Later on, he'd be condemned by Jews, by scholars, by right-wingers. Say, oh, he was no good. But I want to read to you the last line of Lichtman's book. And it's telling. Maybe you'll agree with it, maybe you won't. But I want to read it to you. Listen carefully. Let the ears perk up for a second. The following. Felix Frankfurter said this. Fluctuations of historic judgment are the lot of great men, and Roosevelt will not escape it. But if history has its claims, so has the present. For it has been wisely said that if the judgment of the time must be corrected by that of posterity, it is no less true that the judgment of posterity must be corrected by that of the time. It's a chachma, a brilliant idea, meaning sometimes it takes the passing of 30, 40, 50 years for the historical record for posterity to figure out the emes, the truth, and that the initial assessment is in error. But sometimes also the posterity, the judgment of the scholars of 30, 40, 50 years later, takes a wrong turn and must be corrected on the basis of the initial assessment of the time, which was, among American Jews, favorable towards their 32nd president. So that's the way the book ends. Now, some people might agree with that sentiment. Some people might not. All I can say is that in the post-war era, there were two schools of thought. And in some families, you had both. What happens if in the baby boomer generation, living in Queens, and you have one family that's a real Yankee doodle that came to America in 1900, and another family were Holocaust survivors, and they live on the same block. And families intermarry with each other, and Shalom al Yisrael, happy Jewish family. But grandma on one side is an Auschwitz survivor, and grandma on the other side is the wife of a World War II veteran from the U.S. Army. So the Yankee family, they're going to say, Roosevelt was our hero, the Gadol Hador. And the Auschwitz survivor is going to spit on Roosevelt's grave. Now, and every other issue, Shalom al Yisrael, we're happy, you know, Jews, we get along, we agree on things, fine. But on this issue, you're going to have a tremendous divide. Why? Personal experience. What's the truth? Everybody has their own truth. But if you felt that you could have gotten to America in 1938, 39, but some State Department consular official in Budapest, in Berlin, in Warsaw, in Vilna, in Kovno, wherever, rejected your passport, and you spent 5 years in a concentration camp because of it, then when you get to America, you have a bitter a taste in your mouth towards the 32nd president and the whole institution of the American government, even though they let you in after the war. Whereas if you spent the war years in bases in the American South, bases out west, on a boat to Burma, on a boat to England to fight at Normandy, well, guess what? Roosevelt was your hero. So we can't fault people for having different opinions based on different personal experiences. And on that note, I'll take some questions.
Okay. It's me.
No questions?
It's me, Tina. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Tina.
Excellent. I have a question. Number one, isn't the president commander-in-chief? As commander-in-chief, if he was well-versed in what he was supposed to be well-versed in, could he not have ordered the military to do what he wanted them to do? Okay? I mean, the bombing of Auschwitz, They flew over
anyway. So the answer is yes. He could have authorized whatever he wanted, but I don't believe that the president had that much day-to-day knowledge of the specific flight patterns of U.S. bombers flying from Italy going northbound over Poland. I don't think that he had that kind of, you know, precise knowledge. And I'm not saying that to be an apologist for Roosevelt. I'm saying that just because I don't think he had that knowledge. If he did have that knowledge, would he have authorized it? Probably still not. I'm not here to defend him and say what he would have done differently. I just don't think he had the knowledge.
Roosevelt's goal was to win the war. Everything else was secondary and tertiary to what he wanted to do. So the thought of
that's true.
You know, for whatever, but it's such a shanda that he couldn't do it. It's such a shanda that he didn't bomb those tracks.
So, you know, on a discussion of the bombing of the tracks, it's telling that there was not that much of a discussion among American Jews about pressuring the government to do this. There was an element of pressure, but not all that much. And when it wasn't done, it didn't lead to some kind of an outcry. It was not seen as the panacea. and it wouldn't have been one.
You made a mention of trying to find neutral countries to take the Jews. Well, what happened with Cuba? Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, why wouldn't they let them in? I mean, Cuba was a travesty.
So Cuba turned against letting in Jews after they had let in about 24,000 or thereabouts. Or actually, they'd let in less, but there was a total of about 24,000 Jews in Cuba by 1942. The Cubans had domestic right-wing political considerations and Nazis on the ground who did not like Jews. And there was only so much Havana could take in terms of an ethnic economy based in diamonds. Cuba did its fair share. Sure, they could have done more, but they were politically disinclined to do more.
I see. And they were disinclined.
What about the St. Louis?
St. Louis, that's what it is.
So this, as I mentioned last time, when it comes to the St. Louis, the St. Louis had a favorable resolution in the moment that when the countries of France, England, Belgium, and the Netherlands decided to split up, divide the 937 passengers in fourths, at the moment, that was seen as a good solution, not as good as going to America or being in the Western Hemisphere, but since the war hadn't started yet and none of these countries had been occupied by the Germans, nobody could know for sure that anybody was going to be in danger. So it turned out to be a disaster for those who didn't go to England because they were still in continental Europe and they would face life under Nazi occupation, and 254 would die. But in the moment, it was not seen as a disastrous outcome.
Can you clarify again why Bergson turned out to be so tarnished? Why nobody liked him?
Okay, so Bergson turned out to have a lot of enemies because, number one, mainstream Jewish Americans did not like that that he was stealing their thunder and getting more publicity and getting the attention of members of Congress and the government and celebrities. So for all the A-listers and B-listers were flocking to Bergson's pageants. And Stephen Wise, yeah, he had Senator Wagner, but he wasn't getting this kind of Hollywood type acclaim. That's one factor. The other is he was an Irgunist. And the Irgun was a terrorist organization, at least in the eyes of much of American Jewry, and certainly in the eyes of mainstream Zionists. Also, Bergson was seen as a shameless self-promoter and jumping from one issue to another just to have renown, from the army issue to the rescue issue. And then after 45, what happened? So he was promoting statehood, and then goes to Israel and gets arrested after the Altalena episode, spends some time in prison, then is released, runs for the Knesset on the fighters list, and spends a half a term in the Knesset, causes a big stink because he objects to Ben-Gurion turning the Constituent Assembly into the first Knesset. So if you remember from a few years ago, we learned that the first Knesset election in January of 1949 was not supposed to be for a parliament. It was supposed to be a Constituent Assembly to draft the Constitution. But guess what happened? Does Israel have a Constitution? No. Even to this day, it has no Constitution because they couldn't come up with one. So Ben-Gurion sort of unilaterally declared this is no longer a Constituent Assembly. This is a regular parliament to conduct governmental business like any other parliament. And Bergson or Hillel Cook got up and slammed the table and says, no, you're a totalitarian dictator. And that was the end of it. And he left Israel. He moved to America, stayed in America until 1968, I think, then moved back to Israel, gave a lot of interviews, became a left-winger, supported Palestinian statehood in the territories, and basically was disillusioned with Israel. The Israel that was founded, Medinat Israel as it actually existed, was not the Hebrew state of the Jews that he was hoping for. So everybody sort of despised him by the end. Okay. On that note, we'll stop for tonight. This concludes our discussion of Roosevelt and Holocaust-related issues. Next week, we're going to discuss GI Jews, American Jewish servicemen in the military during the war, based upon a review of Deborah Dash Moore's book, GI Jews. If you don't want to read the book, you can watch the movie. Go to PBS Documentaries. You can watch it. We'll see you next time. Take care, everybody.